Good day, and welcome to the Cigna Eating Disorder Awareness Series conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Kate Harner. Please go ahead.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for calling in to Cigna's 2014 Eating Disorder Awareness Series. My name is Kate Harner, and I'm a care manager on the Eating Disorder team with Cigna. Due to the format of the call today, you'll not be able to ask questions during the teleconference. However, at the end of the conference, there will be a brief five-question survey in which we are requesting your feedback on your experience of today's seminar. After that survey, you will be able to ask questions of today's speaker. A handout for the presentation is available online at www.cigna.com/eatingdisorders. Halfway down the page under the heading Current Topics, you'll see the link for today's presentation in blue entitled Recognizing the Medical Complications of Eating Disorders. Again, visit the Awareness Series page online at www.cigna.com/eatingdisorders. Halfway down the page under the heading Current Topics, you'll see the link for today's presentation in blue entitled Recognizing the Medical Complications of Eating Disorders. Please also notice the blue square in the top section of the page that you may click on to sign up for future seminars. It's not required that you sign up in order to attend each month. However, if you choose to sign up, you will receive email reminders for each month's presentation. Today, I have the pleasure of introducing our speaker, Dr. Anna Vinter. Dr. Vinter is the medical director of the Eating Recovery Center of California. Today, she'll be sharing information with us on the medical complications of eating disorders. Welcome, Dr. Vinter.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm happy to do this. So as mentioned, I will be talking about the medical complications of eating disorders. And right at the beginning, I want to be clear, I'm going to be talking about two types, and they are medical complications of restricting eating disorders and medical complications of purging eating disorders. Because, of course, bodies don't make diagnostic distinctions. So bodies are not thinking, do I meet the criteria for anorexia nervosa? Am I purging frequently enough to meet the criteria for bulimia nervosa? No. What I'm talking about is really what is the damage to the bodies who endure these behaviors in the course of an eating disorder. We ourselves, when we're seeing patients, are thinking about what is the diagnostic category that the patient falls into, but the damage occurs no matter what we end up diagnosing the patient with. And the damage really does fall into the categories based on the behavior. So that's what we'll be talking about today. And also, to be clear, I will not be talking about binge eating disorder today, only to keep the talk focused, not because it doesn't deserve the discussion. And, in fact, it really does merit its own webinar if there hasn't already been one. Okay, and I will be going through the slides today, so please feel free to follow along with the talk. I will be referring to them as I'm talking. Who might benefit from this talk? Well, this particular talk is really directed at family members, therapists, dietitians, or someone who herself or himself is struggling with an eating disorder. And for that reason, I'm going to try to keep this talk as jargon-free as possible. There's plenty of jargon, as I'm sure you will know, in the medical field, and it's not particularly helpful when we're just trying to communicate information directly. And what happens is, usually when you know someone with an eating disorder or you yourself have one, you know something is wrong, but really you may not know just how serious the problem is, and you may not know how to advocate for yourself to get the help that you need or to get the help that the person that you care about needs. So we're going to talk about the specific medical complications that may help you be able to talk directly to a healthcare professional to let them know, because they may not know exactly what kind of problems are going on. And one of the reasons that it's really important to provide this information, well, there are several reasons, and I'm going to go through some of them. One of the main reasons is that eating disorders actually may be invisible. Eating disorders occur in males and females. For a while, what we used to say is that about 90% of people with eating disorders were females. But in fact, with more recent studies, it's looking like probably more on the order of 25% of people with eating disorders are males, but tend not to be diagnosed, in part because boys and men don't think of themselves as having eating disorders, and in part because healthcare providers don't really look, because we aren't really thinking about men and boys as having eating disorders. Also, people in average and large-sized bodies can experience starvation and malnourishment. And even experienced clinicians may not recognize the medical consequences of eating disorders. So many healthcare providers do not have enough training in the recognition and treatment of eating disorders, and they therefore may actually inadvertently provide false reassurance because the person they're looking at doesn't meet the stereotype of a person with an eating disorder. So you or someone you care about may go in for a medical visit and see a doctor, and the doctor may look at the patient, this person with the eating disorder, say, you look fine, you look great, no problem, just because they don't look like kind of this stereotype, very, very underweight person with anorexia. But that doesn't mean that they're not gravely ill. And sometimes you, the person with the eating disorder, the clinician seeing the person or the family member, will be the one who actually has to sound the alarm because you're the one who knows how serious the issue is. And sometimes you actually have to do this over and over until you can get the attention of a medical provider to take you seriously. It's unfortunate, but it does happen that way sometimes. Another reason this is really important to go through this, eating disorders come in all sizes. So here's a nice quote. Weight is not the only clinical marker of an eating disorder. People who are at normal weight and high weight can have eating disorders. And actually, I'd like to give you an example of that. So right now in our treatment center, I have several patients who would meet the criteria for anorexia nervosa, but for their current weight. And there's a weight requirement for a diagnosis of anorexia. So these patients started in larger sized bodies, and they've lost weight precipitously and dramatically and are now suffering the very same medical consequences we would expect in someone who lost the same amount of weight to the point of visible starvation. And in fact, one of these patients went to her primary care doctor and was referred to a weight loss specialist who prescribed medication to help her lose weight, even though she was passing out at work because she was starving herself. So you can see how people, when they see a larger sized body, go down a whole different route of treatment options. But that doesn't mean that the person doesn't have a very serious eating disorder. The other reason it's really important to identify eating disorders and treat them seriously is because they're extremely deadly. So anorexia nervosa has the highest mortality rate of any psychiatric disorder. And we talk about this frequently, so you may have already heard this, but that's absolutely true. And about 40% of the deaths in anorexia are from suicide, which is sort of a startling figure. So it speaks to both how serious it is and how serious it is to take the mental state of the person with the eating disorder. And I'm going to talk more about this in just a little bit. I'm going to show you a table that I'd like to go into more detail on. So if you're following along in the slides, please go to the next one. It's titled Comparison of Mortality. This takes a little bit of work to go through, but I really would like to focus on this because it's pretty important. So the concept here is the standardized mortality ratio. And what that means is we're comparing the rate of death to someone with this diagnosis, whatever this diagnosis is, and we'll go through them, to someone else who is basically age-matched. And the age-matched person has a standardized mortality ratio of 1. So that's the typical age that they would die at. When we go through, or the rate that they would die at, when we go through this list, I'm going to go through and read them off to you and show you how much more likely they are to die. So bipolar disorder has a standardized mortality ratio of 4.3 as opposed to the normal rate of 1. Pretty high. Similarly, with depression, 4.9. Schizophrenia all the way up to 7.3. But now look at the next category. So the next category is bulimia nervosa, with an age range of 25 to 44. This is dramatically higher, 7.7. The standardized mortality ratio is 7.7 compared to 1 for someone who is in that same age range without bulimia. Pretty dramatic. Fortunately, for the younger group, it's not quite as deadly. That is 4.4. But again, that's even more deadly than someone who has bipolar disorder, which we tend to think of as a pretty significantly impairing and deadly psychiatric illness. And now the most dramatic one is anorexia nervosa in the age range of 25 to 44. That standardized mortality ratio is 14, quite dramatic, and still dramatic as well in this young age group, 15 to 24, the standardized mortality ratio is 11.5. So 11.5 in this young group, 15 to 24, much higher than any of the other mental illnesses that I've listed there. And this is an article that just came out this year, 2014. So this is recent data from a good study that was done. And just to go back to the issue about suicide in this patient group, one of the other things that we found that's interesting, but not in an amusing way. So typically, women, when they make suicide attempts, what we find is more often they use non-lethal methods. What we find in patients with anorexia who make suicide attempts, and they're typically women because more people with eating disorders are women, they use very deadly means, so gunshot, hanging, that sort of thing. So you can see why the death rate from suicide is much higher in someone with anorexia who attempts suicide than someone without it, because there's something about this illness that when they're attempting suicide, they're not joking at that point. Okay, one more reason that it's absolutely critical to recognize and treat eating disorders, we have to know that they're there, right? So we have to be able to recognize someone with an eating disorder, and we need to treat them right away. So what we know is earlier diagnosis and treatment of eating disorders lead to fewer medical complications and better outcomes. The sooner we diagnose them, the sooner we treat them. The sooner we treat them, the better the outcome. Now, I want to give you a couple resources. This slide, the one that says resource number one, it's not very pretty, but that is a good website for you to download this entire booklet in PDF form. This is put together by the Academy of Eating Disorders, and it's really helpful. This is a nice booklet that you can print out. You used to be able to request it to be mailed to you, but the good news is they're actually working on a new version. But this is still a fine version. It has really straightforward information about medical complications of eating disorders, lab work that's often ordered to find out what's going on. And what you can do with this is print it out, and you can take it with you to your medical provider or to the emergency department, because a lot of times if you go in for medical care, the person you're seeing does not have much information about assessment and treatment of someone with an eating disorder, and this book is quite helpful in that regard. The next resource is this book written by Dr. Philip Mailer, who actually is our chief medical officer of Eating Recovery Center. He has a fantastic amount of knowledge about treatment of eating disorders, and in fact still runs a unit called Acute at a hospital named Denver Health, and not surprisingly, Denver, which is a treatment facility for patients who are the most acutely ill that you possibly could be from an eating disorder. He has extensive knowledge about treating patients with eating disorders. And this book is a little bit more technical, but very comprehensive. So if you have some specific questions about what kind of things can go wrong when someone has an eating disorder, this is a really nice reference for that. And you can find this anywhere, including on Amazon. Okay, so now let's get to the actual medical complications. And again, I want to go back to remembering that what we're talking about are the behaviors as opposed to specifically the diagnoses, because sometimes we can get hung up on whether the person has officially been diagnosed. And what we want to focus on is it's the behaviors that lead to the medical consequences. Now, in anorexia, the restricting type, the medical complications are due to the actual starvation and the weight loss. That's what causes the medical problem. Whereas in bulimia, or purging disorders in general, the medical complications are typically from the type of purging, so that would be vomiting, using laxatives or diuretics generally, and the frequency of purging, how often someone is doing it. They're much less likely to have serious medical consequences if it's happening here and there, maybe once a week, once a month, as opposed to multiple times per day. First, let's start with restricting anorexia. And if you're looking at this slide, let me see if I can tell you what number slide this is. So that is, I think that's slide number 13. I wish I could tell you, give you the citation for this. Unfortunately, I found this from the University of Google online in their images. I love this image, and I have another one for bulimia. It just does a great job of, the image itself is nice and lists all of the different things that can go horribly wrong when someone has anorexia. And the point is all systems are involved, all body systems. No system is spared. It's incredibly, incredibly damaging. And I'm going to go through some of the specific ones as we go through the slides, but this is a nice place if you want to just look through in a good summary. This is a good slide for that. So there are general symptoms. These are the ones that we can kind of recognize in just about anyone who is severely underweight. Obviously, there's the weight loss. There's generally quite fatigued. Sleep gets quite disrupted, and of course, there's muscle wasting, and that's very obvious. And then in this little diagram here, this gives a nice idea about how the weight loss causes a real reinforcing cycle. So there's the fear of getting fat, and then the attempts to lose weight, and the actual weight loss, the diet and physical exertion, which does lead to the weight loss. As a consequence of the weight loss, you see hormonal and physiological changes, including loss of period. And then all of this leads to depression and cognitive disorders, which only intensifies the distorted thinking, the fear of getting fat, even though they're getting smaller and smaller and smaller, again, leading right back into the cycle, which becomes harder and harder to get oneself out of. And then there are the psychiatric consequences. This sort of becomes the chicken and egg question in some ways. We're wondering, are these problems caused by the starvation or are they pre-existing? And what we know is the answer really is both. So depression is often comorbid, which means it coexists with anorexia. That means that someone may have both the anorexia and a pre-existing depression, a depression that would be there even if the person was not anorexic. But what we also know is that depression results from starvation and may in fact completely resolve when someone is adequately fed. Anxiety often predates the anorexia, and you may notice, so for example, if you're a parent listening, you may notice that your child is someone who had an anxious temperament even before any eating issues developed, and you may also have had a child who had OCD or some other anxiety disorder, formal anxiety disorder, before the anorexia developed. That's quite common as well. But as you might imagine, in the midst of starvation, the anxiety only gets worse. And then, as mentioned before, the suicidality is the terrible result. Now, let's talk about the dermatologic issues. So this is what we are looking at when we see someone with anorexia. And this is generally someone who's severely underweight. We start to see hair changes and loss. And people with anorexia notice this and are troubled by it. Nobody likes losing their hair. They may not be particularly aware of what we call lanugo. I don't know if you know about this, but you can see in the photo there's this fine downy hair that starts to develop. You'll see it along the face, the arms, and it's like the body's kind of trying to provide some way to keep itself warm because it's losing all of its insulation. You'll also notice dry skin, brittle nails, and something called acrocyanosis, which I'm about to show you a picture of. Acrocyanosis is when you start to see bluing of the skin, particularly in the extremities. So in the photo on the left, you'll see the hand is looking distinctly bluer than the more normal one on the right. And it's quite prominent. You'll see this in people with anorexia. You just look at their hands and they're kind of always bluish to purplish. The other thing that you'll see in someone with anorexia is what's called delayed capillary refill. This is a very easy test that you can do with someone. This is, of course, you don't require any medical training for this. You can just do this right there sitting next to the person. And you can poke on your own feet or hands or legs and poke on that person's, and then you let go, and you see how long it takes for the blood to reperfuse or come back again. And that person may actually have some white fingerprints for quite a while, whereas your hands or wherever you've poked will pink right back up. So their circulation is not good at all. Now, cardiovascular. So this is a big one for a variety of reasons. Patients with anorexia are likely to have arrhythmias, or at least that's our great fear. That's our thought that that's one of the main causes of death. So, of course, we're quite worried about that. The other reason this is a big deal is because this is one of the things that happens when we send patients or when they go in for medical visits. They'll have a low heart rate, which we call bradycardia, and a doctor will say, fantastic, you've got an athletic heart. So I have to tell you, this is one of the things that is just is absolutely frustrating for me, because this happens a lot. We'll have patients here in our partial hospitalization program. They come in with a critically low heart rate, and we will sometimes send them to a cardiologist, typically not, because what they need is just to be refed and their heart rate will come back up. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. But sometimes if it takes a long time to come back up, or if the patient or family is really wanting another second opinion, they'll go see a cardiologist. And unfortunately, many cardiologists don't have much experience treating patients with eating disorders, and they'll go and they'll say, great, it's an athletic heart. Now, it absolutely is not. That is absolutely not the cause of a low heart rate in someone with a serious restricting eating disorder. And there are several ways to tell this. One is, if I went back to the previous slide, showing the delayed capillary refill, what's happening is the person is slowing down all of their functions. And almost every single doctor who treats patients with eating disorders comes up with their own way of explaining what's going on. I kind of describe this as going into hibernation. So your body is trying to slow down every single function that it can to preserve its energy, because it has none whatsoever to spare. And it's pretty dramatic if you think about it, that one of the vital functions, beating the heart, even that is being compromised. It's having to slow down because there's not even enough energy to keep that going. So things that you'll notice, low body temperature, cold hands, poor circulation, low heart rate, and then I have low blood pressure right there. And in particular, there's a phenomenon that we call orthostatic hypotension. So hypotension is low blood pressure. Orthostatic hypotension is when someone is laying down, their blood pressure is one thing and their pulse is one thing, typically the low pulse, low heart rate. And then we have them stand up, wait for a minute, and we check it again, and it will drop, it will increase pretty dramatically. Now, if it increases pretty dramatically from doing something as simple as standing up, that is not an athletic heart. If you think about a nice, robust heart, doing something easy like standing up should not cause any sort of indication of exertion. It shouldn't take any kind of work to do that. So vital signs should not change when someone just goes from lying down to standing in any profound way. But typically with someone with pretty severe medical compromise from their anorexia, it will. So that's one of the indicators that we measure when we see patients. This is something that is just very frustrating, because so often people will be inappropriately reassured by doctors who don't know about the medical complications of eating disorders, and it can lead to postponing absolutely necessary medical treatment. Moving on, another indicator of the slowing down the activities because there's not enough energy to fuel it, low body temperature, as I mentioned, which is called hypothermia. The body in someone who's got severe restricting anorexia also runs out of its glucose stores. So the person will develop hypoglycemia. And in this picture, and I will read this out loud also in case you're not following along on the slides, not able to right now, symptoms of hypoglycemia, low blood sugar. So the person will become shaky, sweaty, anxious. They'll develop a fast heartbeat. Sometimes they'll get blurry vision. They're very fatigued, hungry, although people with anorexia don't always necessarily identify that as a sense of hunger. They can get headachy and very irritable. Another fascinating thing about hypoglycemia is that people will often develop hypoglycemia at night, and that's not that surprising because they may be eating little things throughout the day, kind of barely maintaining an adequate level of blood sugar. And then they go to sleep and there's nothing coming in, and so the body absolutely burns through the last little bit that it's got and then becomes hypoglycemic. Now, people who get hypoglycemic at night will often wake up and feel like they're having a panic attack. And so they'll wake up, they feel like they were having a horrible nightmare, they're sweating, shaky, feeling panicky, terrible. It feels like a panic attack, right? But it's actually because of hypoglycemia. Now, this is not to be ignored. Hypoglycemia is actually a medical emergency. And the newer thinking about hypoglycemia is that actually may be the immediate cause of sudden death in people with anorexia. So we take this very seriously. Also, another thing that can happen is people can develop what looks like low thyroid hormone. In fact, their thyroids are functioning okay, and just resuming adequate nutrition will balance everything out. So we do not need to correct thyroid hormone. We don't do thyroid supplementation in someone with anorexia. We just feed them. Our constant mantra, food is medicine, food is medicine. Here, gastrointestinal symptoms, this is what you'll hear. And or if you're someone with an eating disorder, this is what you will probably struggle with the most of all. So what happens is when you've been restricting your intake for a significant amount of time, the movement of food through the stomach actually gets delayed. And that's called gastroparesis, or some people pronounce it gastroparesis. This is quite significant in some people. It happens almost universally when someone loses about 10% of their body weight through pure restriction. And as a consequence of that, then it seems that the intestinal system as well also slows down, probably just because there's not much in there, and it's trying to absorb as much of the nutrients as it can and slowing the process of food going through the intestines. What that leads to is constipation. With delayed movement of food through the stomach, you get an uncomfortable feeling of fullness and perhaps even nausea after eating. And it makes it very hard to start eating again. So when people come into our treatment center, the first thing that they notice when they start eating food routinely is unbelievable discomfort. And typically this is not a dangerous thing. There are some rare significant medical complications, which I don't think I'll go into too much right now, but because it's really exceedingly rare, the main thing is it's just this. And we just manage the symptoms. We help someone through that. But it's very uncomfortable. It's very off-putting. And if you're a family member trying to help someone with anorexia, restricting anorexia to start eating again, what they're going to tell you is, I can't. It hurts too much. And they're not lying. It's very painful. And it's because they've gone so long without eating that their stomach is not moving the food through very quickly. Okay. Hormonal issues. So, of course, until the DSM, that's the diagnostic manual that psychiatrists use to diagnose any sort of mental illness, just came out with a new version in May of 2013, changing some of the criteria, which actually psychiatrists were quite pleased with. But before that, one of the diagnostic criteria for anorexia nervosa was loss of periods. So that's in some way sort of a hallmark of what happens with anorexia. So that's a major and important indicator of physical compromise. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. And the sort of matching consequence of that for boys is low testosterone in men. And what I wanted to get back to with the loss of the period is a pretty good indicator also of bone loss and low testosterone for men as well. And this is absolutely critical for young people. We really only have about until we're age 30 to lay down our bones. And after that, we're kind of withdrawing from the bone bank, basically. So if someone develops a restricting eating disorder, anorexia, in their teen years, which is when almost everybody develops one, and their hormones get low, so loss of estrogen and testosterone, depending on the gender, they are not laying down this critical bone work, so they are likely to develop osteopenia or even osteoporosis. It's quite dramatic how rapidly that happens, and this is one of the few irreversible consequences of anorexia. So we worry about this quite a lot, and this is one of the reasons that I had mentioned before how important it is to diagnose and treat eating disorders as early as possible. This is absolutely something that we do not want to occur, because we can't undo it. One other body system that can be pretty drastically affected by eating disorders is the hematologic or blood system. What you can see is actually a complete blood cell development failure. And what happens, so our blood cells are made in the bone marrow, and what happens is the bone marrow sort of turns into this gelatinous goo instead of this nice, robust, cell-producing material. And so you'll see a decrease in any or all of the blood cells, which can be red blood cells. And so if that gets low, well, you'll see anemia. It can be white blood cells. Then you'll get a loss of white blood cells, and those are the infection-fighting cells. Or you could see a loss of production of platelets, and those are clotting cells. Now, the interesting thing, and we don't really understand why this is so entirely, is that even when patients get incredibly low in their white blood cells, they don't seem to be at risk for infection the way, for example, cancer patients on chemotherapy are. It probably has to do with not having an underlying other problem like cancer or, for example, an HIV/AIDS when they're, you know, when they're immune compromised and their white blood cells are low, then they are at risk for infection. But there isn't something else wrong other than the malnourishment in patients with anorexia. Nevertheless, we don't like to see this happening. But again, this is one of the things that does bounce right back as soon as the person starts eating reliably. Okay, so now let's move to bulimia, or more broadly, purging disorders. And again, here's one of these pictures that I really adore with a good list of basically all of the things that you might see, medical complications. And we'll go back to the general symptoms. Now, with bulimia or purging disorders, you can see weight loss or weight gain. It is not specific, so typically someone is purging in an attempt to lose weight, but it's basically a pretty ineffective method, and more often than not, someone with a purging disorder is of normal weight. Again, one of these reasons is they're not diagnosed regularly, they're not identified, because they're not in this stereotypical emaciated state often enough. And sometimes they'll even gain weight, and I'll talk a little bit more coming up about why that can be so. They're often fatigued, and again, their sleep gets very disrupted. Psychiatrically, you can see some of the same things as we see in anorexia, as well as some other issues. So depression and anxiety, as I had mentioned before. Now, addiction is something that's much more common in someone with bulimia. Interestingly, for people with anorexia, purely restricting type, that actually seems to be almost a protective factor against addiction. They seem to have lower rates of addiction, even than the general population. Just the opposite for bulimia, much higher rates of addiction. So that is something that we often are having to treat at the same time that we're treating the eating disorder. And we do that quite a bit here. So we often have patients who come in with alcohol addiction or other drug addiction that we need to treat. And of course, you can't just treat one thing at a time, so we treat both. And suicide, again, is a significant problem in patients with purging disorders. And then mood swings. So you can imagine in someone who goes back and forth between sometimes eating enough food, sometimes purging it, sometimes binging, their moods can be all over the place. And I sometimes joke that I have patients who come in here and I cure their bipolar disorder, which, of course, I'm doing nothing like that. But really what's happening is I'm regulating their food intake to a consistent level, and all of a sudden the mood swings that looked like bipolar disorder are not bipolar disorder, and their moods regulate, and lo and behold, we get to get them off their mood stabilizing medication. However, of course, bipolar disorder can coexist with bulimia, and that's not uncommon either, so we have to be pretty thoughtful about what's causing what. Again, this chicken and the egg question. Okay, so HEENT is sort of an acronym that doctors use to cover head, eyes, ears, nose, and throat. It's just easier to write it down, as you might imagine. Lots of different things can happen with purging disorders. There are a few that I've written here, and then I'll tell you about a couple more as well. Dental erosion. So when someone is regurgitating, vomiting, as you know, stomach acid is acidy, right? And so it can damage the teeth. In this photo, it's a pretty dramatic example, and you can see the teeth even in the front are quite damaged on the bottom. On the top, they don't look damaged, but that's because those are veneers. And you can see in the bottom left photo the actual teeth and then the veneer on top. Typically, it's the inside surface of the teeth, which kind of makes sense because that's the side that is touched by the vomit as it's going by. But the damage to the teeth can be pretty significant. And dentists who are savvy will notice that on dental exams and can even sometimes be the person who first identifies the bulimia in the patient and can refer them to the appropriate treatment source. Another thing that can happen is parotid gland swelling. So if you look in the photo on the right, the woman has very swollen cheeks. And that, interestingly, occurs after someone stops purging. So just a couple days, 3 or 4 days or so, 2 to 4 days after they stop purging, they get very swollen cheeks. And it's not that difficult to treat most of the time, and it does go away. But this is something that you really have to help someone with when they come in for treatment. And you have to really give a lot of information and help them with the symptoms, because you can imagine when you're, look at this picture, it looks pretty uncomfortable. And in someone who's self-conscious about their appearance, they're not very happy when that occurs. It's not very conducive to stopping purging. We don't really understand why that happens. We don't know why it happens after they stop purging. But it does happen. It doesn't happen in everyone, but for the people it does happen to, it doesn't make them want to stop. And so we really need to give a lot of education about what's going on and that we do have treatment for that. I will not name any names, but you might very well be watching Oscars or Emmys or any other sort of Hollywood shows, and you may see some famous people with some pretty prominent cheeks, which makes you wonder about some of their behaviors. I have no particular people in mind. I've just noticed some of those cheek swelling that's very, very characteristic. So the other thing that you often will hear from patients is they have sore throats, and again, for the same reason, acid vomit coming up. It, of course, it's quite damaging to the throat and uncomfortable. Two other things that I didn't put on the list here but can also happen, frequent bloody noses. So the pressure of the vomiting can actually cause bloody noses and can also cause rupture of the blood vessels in the eyes. So you may see red and the broken vessels in the eyes also for the same reason, the increased pressure. And again, gastrointestinal issues. Almost always, the gastrointestinal issues are the ones that can be absolutely most distressing for the people with the eating disorder. Heartburn, for the very same reason that I was just talking about the other symptoms, so the acid reflux with the vomit coming up, and those can even cause ulcers. And more concerningly, bleeding and esophageal tear or rupture. That can actually be fatal. So that would be obviously a terrible consequence. Something else that we worry quite a bit about is constipation from laxative abuse. That's very common. So laxative abuse, in my experience, is very common, but not something that a lot of people like to talk about. And somehow there's sort of a cachet. It's more socially acceptable to restrict than it is to purge. And unless you ask very specifically about laxative abuse, most people won't volunteer that information. But it has a lot of significant medical consequences, one of which is permanent bowel muscle damage, neurologic damage to the bowel muscle, which is called cathartic colon syndrome. And that is terrible. That is when you have used so many laxatives that you've actually damaged the nervous system in the large bowel so much that it can no longer move the bowels out. So essentially it's an inert tube. It does not do anything. And at that point, and we never know when that point is, people may end up with a colectomy. That's a removal of the colon, and get a colostomy bag. And again, people who are particularly worried about their appearance, and that's why they're doing these behaviors, and of course that's not the only reason, but one of the reasons, may end up with a colostomy, nothing that they would have ever anticipated. And people who are abusing laxatives may have in their mind sort of a justification like, well, I'm not using that many, it's not even that much more than the box says, but they're using them ongoing. But our concern with that is it's different for each person, and we have no idea when that is. And so we just ask people to stop immediately. And we don't have any idea when it is that will be the very, that's the point that they've done the damage. And there's no rationale for tapering down. If you think about it, if you've gotten to the point where you're doing, let's say, 80 laxatives a day, and that's what it takes to move your bowels, 40 laxatives is not going to do anything. So you just have to stop completely. And we have nice treatments to help manage that definitely no reason for tapering off. Okay, cardiovascular. Arrhythmias, again, absolutely a major concern. Again, bradycardia can be a problem. And then palpitations, so that can happen for a couple of reasons, perhaps from low potassium, from vomiting. I'm going to come to that in a minute. And also high blood pressure and also palpitations, often from diet pill toxicity. So usually that will have some form of stimulant, usually caffeine, but other things. You know, Ephedra was one of them for a while. That's now off the market, but people can still get it, and there's always something that you can get online or on the diet pill market that is always a stimulant to try to be an appetite suppressant, and those will often cause palpitations and high blood pressure. Metabolic, so what I was just mentioning was the low potassium. And in this picture, this is actually something that medical students will often use to, this is called a mnemonic, so something that medical students will use to remember the consequences of low potassium. And some of them include shallow respirations, irritability, confusion, weakness, but the main one would be arrhythmias, because that can be fatal, and lethargy, decreased intestinal motility. So again, here's another reason for someone having constipation. There's a fairly wide range of normal potassium values, but the low end actually is not enough for the intestines to be moving regularly and comfortably. Dehydration from the variety of forms of purging. And then there's something, a disruption in acid-base balance that can also occur, which is alkalosis, metabolic alkalosis, which is actually the top of the list of the low potassium side effects as well. Hormonal issues, irregular periods, major problem, especially for fertility if someone is trying to get pregnant when they're still having purging symptoms or behaviors. And then there's this very interesting and off-putting phenomenon called pseudo-Barter syndrome, where the fluid balance becomes very disrupted. And kind of like the swelling of the cheek, this occurs after stopping purging, where patients will get extreme swelling. And again, this will feel like a reason not to stop purging. And patients will have had a horrible experience where they will have tried to stop purging. They'll go into the ER to maybe treat their low potassium, and they will be given IV fluid, and they'll get it too rapidly, and they will absolutely swell up. They'll put on 10 pounds just from that one visit to the ER. Very upsetting and disruptive, and will make patients decide, oh, I'm never going to go into the ER, which is absolutely the worst thing, because they can be critically ill and need emergent treatment. Again, it requires both gentle treatment that we can help with and reassurance that this is a normal phenomenon that will regulate. Okay, getting near the end now. As I mentioned, most medical complications from eating disorders will resolve with appropriate and adequate treatment. One of them that will not is the osteoporosis. The other is that there appear to be some brain changes that can occur that we're not sure whether they will improve over time and whether there are clinical implications for that. And that is it. This is our facility, and I welcome anybody contacting me for any questions at all. And thank you very much.
To help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. If you are a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in this survey. After the survey, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. After I finish reading the entire question and all of the possible responses, please answer by pressing the star key followed by the number that corresponds to your choice. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Question 1. This session provided me with a better understanding of medical complications with eating disorders. Star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 disagree, and star 4 strongly disagree. We will now pause to gather your responses. Question number 2. This session educated me on signs and symptoms of medical issues related to eating disorders. Star 1, strongly agree. Star 2, agree. star 3, disagree, and star 4, strongly disagree. Please stand by while we allow everyone a chance to respond. Question number 3. Overall, this session met my expectations. Star 1, strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. And star 4, strongly disagree. Again, we will pause to allow everyone a chance to signal. Question number 4. I would recommend this program to others. Star 1, agree. And star 2, disagree. Again, we will pause to allow everyone a chance to signal. Question number 5. Please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with an eating disorder. Star 1, I am an individual with an eating disorder. Star 2, I am a family member of someone with an eating disorder. Star 3, I am a health professional. And star 4, other. Again, we will pause to allow everyone a chance to signal. And that concludes today's survey. At this time, we will conduct a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on the phone line will indicate when your line is open. Please state your name before posing your question. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions. Again, it is star 1 to ask a question. There are no questions in the queue at this time. I would like to turn the call back to Kate Harner.
Thank you, everyone, for attending, and especially thank you to Dr. Anna Vinter for providing us with such wonderful insights today. If anyone on the call has specific questions about any of the topics discussed, please contact the Eating Disorder team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. Please note as well that the series will be on break through the remainder of this year, but will resume again in January. Please check the website towards the end of this year for the 2015 schedule. Thank you for attending and have a great day.
That concludes today's conference call. Thank you for your participation.